Good morning and welcome to RAKT, Feminist Creative Nonfiction and the Evolution of Consciousness, LDS Feminist and Otherwise. This morning we are gifted to hear from Whitney Nelson. She is an English major and senior at Utah Valley University, so ready to launch off into the world. She has recently presented a nonfiction piece about Mormonism at the Pop Culture Conference in New Orleans. So quite a difference from Salt Lake City. We'll be hearing from her about her piece and from her piece. And then we will also hear Julie Nichols discuss that piece. Julie Nichols is a PhD. She teaches creative writing in the Department of English and Literature at Utah Valley University. She's a delighted grandmother of six and a half, gorgeous kids, and an education counselor in her ward's Relief Society presidency. She carries the karma of raving feminism from the earlier incarnation. And we will now hear from Whitney.
Actually, Julie's going to go first.
We're going to mix it all up, just the way we like to do it, when we're Mormon feminists, right?
That's right.
Okay. I'm going to begin by taking a somewhat circuitous route, a path I thought at first was direct and forthright, which is why it's on the program the way it is, but which after some traveling turns out to have been just sort of an on-ramp, the 10-lane highway that Whitney's constructing for us. I'm not going to apologize for this. We need on-ramps, frontage roads, parallel trails. They almost always get us to serendipitous destinations. I found Owen Barfield some months ago during a search for reasons to condemn modern technology. A search about as useful as the search for the direct route to the Indies, right? And yet, what I found was a friend of C.S. Lewis's who is far too little known. Owen Barfield, remember that name. You're going to hear it again. I'll talk about it again some other sunstone. He lived from 1898 to 1997, almost 100 years, in which he wrote prolifically about one tripart thing: the evolution of human consciousness, its traces in language, especially the English language, and the progressive power of metaphor. He gives us some key terms, a kind of legend for the journey we're going to take today. And we kind of need this little legend, so listen carefully. First key term is evolution. Evolution, says Owen Barfield, is the process by which a past form or a past condition is transformed into a future one. The second term is a very important one that we've just said. That's transformation. Transformation as opposed to... I've lost my place. We're going to go back to consciousness. Consciousness. In the whole development of consciousness, we can trace the operation of two opposing principles, he says, or forces. First is the force we find given us to start with as the nature of language itself at its birth. It is the principle of living unity. The second principle is the force by which single meanings tend to split up into a number of separate and often isolated concepts. This is all from Owen Barfield's second wonderful book called Poetic Diction. This is related to a third key term, etymology, the original or true meanings of words. Take rupture, for example. Its ancient Sanskrit root is rupayati, a verb form translatable as he breaks off, causing violent pain. All of that in one root. The word is related to rob, and to disrupt, and to corrupt, and to interrupt. Disrupt is to break off. Corrupt has an intensifier as a prefix, and it can be translated as to break off completely at the front. According to Barfield, words map the evolution of human consciousness as they require us to imagine worlds in which such a variety of current meanings as disrupt, corrupt, and interrupt had not yet crystallized, and only the one ancient meaning, rupayate, to break off with violent pain, inherent. Now we come to transformation. Remember, evolution is the process by which a past form is transformed. Barfield says that transformation, as distinct from substitution, indicates the uninterrupted presence of something common to both the old form and the new. and interior, which is anterior to them both. It follows, therefore, that from within the separate centers that evolve as we break off, that from within the separate centers, from within the ruptures, that uninterrupted anterior map finds new boundaries and new ways to express itself. And if we accept that transformation requires rupture and recreation, Owen Barfield insists that it is the true metaphor, the true juxtaposition of inner and outer in the continually new meanings of words that expands consciousness, expands the boundaries of our being. With her poetic diction, her metaphoric language, the creative nonfictionist seeks the shape of the space of the consciousness which is anterior to the exterior she lives, describes, is inscribed with, and fights against to recreate. She seeks to transform the received, unquestioned map of femaleness into an accurate, usable chart, not to substitute one kind of false idolatry about female power, it's wearing a wedding dress and taking care of your siblings, with another, it's leaving all that behind and being utterly single and unattached. Whitney is one of an entire corpus of women involved in a transformation to something else, and I'm proud to know her and work with her. So there's your on-ramp. There's your legend. From here on out, we're going to deviate, not completely, but some, from the map our program abstract draws for you. The more we worked, the less pertinent we saw it would be to try to explicate Whitney's essay or analyze it via Barfield's brilliant and beloved theories about language, metaphor, and the evolution of consciousness. Instead, we hope you'll indulge us as we attempt to present an expression rather than an explication of those theories, a dialogue, a call and response in which Whitney's work, written and experienced, leads to transformation for herself and for her fellow explorers, her sister explorers, in the strange waters of womanhood as defined by Mormondom. Instead of talking any more about Barfield, as I said, that'll wait for another symposium, I'll be invoking mapping metaphors written by historians, creative nonfictionists, and novelists. A full works cited list is available upon request. Whitney will be reading excerpts from a much longer work in progress, a memoir/personal essay. She will be reading at the Mormon Women's Literary Tour. Now, I'm just going to take a step back just for a minute and advertise that Mormon Women's Literary Tour. There are flyers here. Readings are going to be held all over the country, and we hope you'll take a flyer and join us there. So, let us begin. And I will begin. Sven Burkhardt's memoir is a work comprising at least two timelines, present and past, the now and the then. The many thens create a quasi-spatial illusion, most approximating the sensations of events and situations understood not just in themselves, but as stages en route to decisive self-recognition. Chris Wright. The Mormon personal essay is a sublime travelogue, a raw and vulnerable exploration. Graham Hancock. The making of really good maps requires at least three good ingredients, three key ingredients. Great journeys of discovery, first-class mathematical and cartographic skills, and sophisticated chronometers. It is easy to find latitude by means of angular measurements of the sun and stars taken with relatively simple instruments, but to find longitude, equipment of altogether different caliber is needed, which can combine position measurements with time.
I don't know what it means to be a woman, and in my short 24 years, it's just gotten more complicated. I mean, I know the clinicals and the functions. After my elementary school hosted a maturation program for the sixth graders, Mom and I dined over a couple of Taco Bell's bean burritos, no onions, where she further explained the differences in the male and female anatomy. And by my third refill of root beer, Mom had sketched diagrams and answered every uncomfortable question I hadn't asked. So I've known from an early age that women typically have breasts, a uterus, and ovaries, all thanks to our double X chromosomes. And I thought that's all I needed to be a woman, to feel like a woman, and to be accepted as a woman. As I've gotten older, I've discovered the naivete of my assumptions. I attribute much of my confusion to my upbringing in Orem, Utah, the center of all things Mormon. Having been taught that we're all children of God, I assumed he loved and regarded each child equally. Gender had nothing to do with it. But perhaps I was just too caught up in junior jazz or the great brain to notice the subtle differences. Because to me it was simple. Equal. When assembling a pickup basketball game on the blacktop behind the school, I was usually chosen early because I was a good athlete. But as my classmates and I got older, I dropped in the pecking order, even behind Devin and Marty, neither of whom were better players. In fact, Devin was asthmatic and Marty collected bugs at recess. But they were boys, and that said more about our comparative abilities than our actual athleticism, leaving me skulking on the sidelines until the last boy was chosen. When I asked Mom why this sudden shift occurred, she said it was probably intimidation. Really? I grinned. You think they're intimidated by me? Probably, Mom replied. Most boys aren't used to being outplayed by a girl. I nodded. Yeah, because all the girls at my schools are dancers. So that was it. It all boiled down to a lack of exposure to a girl who could play. And in my 9-year-old mind, that logic worked. I figured they'd get used to it, used to me, and I'd be team captain in no time.
T.S. Spivitz. Children are particularly susceptible to irrational connections. With so much unknown, they are less concerned with the sticky details than with trying to create a working map of the world.
I figured they'd get used to it, used to me, and I'd be team captain in no time. But of course, that never happened. And when I turned 12 and my developing breasts could no longer be hidden by two sports bras and a baggy t-shirt, the boys wouldn't let me play at all. That same year, the gender segregation I experienced on the blacktop surfaced in church. At 12, I was plucked from my mixed-gendered Sunday school class and placed in the young women's program while my male friends were integrated into the young men's program. I didn't understand this division before or after I joined. Both boys and girls were trying to get to heaven, so why corral us into separate classrooms? I sat in my young women's class on Sunday, learning about embroidery and picking at my frayed shoelaces, worried that the boys were learning shortcuts and secret handshakes and passwords vital to our entrance into heaven. Was this segregation designed to lose us? To leave us behind? A religious pick and roll?
Honorius of Autun, AD 1130. There lies in the ocean an island which is called the Lost. In charm, and in all kinds of fertility, it far surpasses every other land, but it is unknown to humankind. Now and again it may be found by chance, but if one seeks it, it cannot be found, and therefore it is called the Lost. Graham Hancock. Perhaps it was their custodianship of knowledge of ancient maps that made the Phoenicians such inquisitive explorers of the margins of the sea, which later navigators feared and called the Sea of Darkness.
Was this segregation designed to lose us, to leave us behind, a religious pick and roll? Shortly after entering the young women's program, I got an answer. People had hinted around the differences between boys and girls, something I'd always chalked up to intimidation, like Mom had said. But in 1993, a few years prior to my young women initiation, the church published The Family, a proclamation to the world. My leaders had passed out copies to all of us one Sunday, and we took turns reading it out loud. But I, a closeted dyslexic terrified of public reading, asked to be excused to use the bathroom. Once I was in the hallway, I folded up the piece of paper, bypassed the bathroom, and walked home. In the empty house, my parents and siblings still at church, I grabbed a glass of milk and unfolded the paper, skimming each paragraph. It was all fairly familiar, but as I read on, my clammy hands trembled, because for the first time I saw the gender divide in writing. quote, "By divine design, fathers are to preside over their family in love and righteousness and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children," end quote. I reread the passage over and over again, each time smothered by a different word. Divine, fathers, preside, mothers, nurture. I tossed the paper aside, put away the milk, and washed my glass. I glanced at the paper again and felt the words tunneling somewhere deep inside, somewhere untouched. It seemed that the roads to heaven were paved quite differently for men and women.
Miles Harvey. The Portuguese controlled the Indies because the Portuguese controlled the maps. Attempting to establish and preserve a trade monopoly, Henry the Navigator and his successors guarded their navigational secrets with an iron hand. "It is impossible to get a chart of the voyage," one trade agent complained in 1501, "because the Portuguese king has decreed the death penalty for anyone sending an accurate map."
On Tuesday nights, the young women gathered together for a weekly church-related activity. These activities hinged on acquiring domestic or homemaking skills, driven no doubt by our divine design to be mothers and wives, to follow our narrative map. From the ages 12 to 15, I cooked, cleaned, quilted, sewed, babysat, and found out that makeup was not optional. I wanted to trust that these activities were inspired by wisdom or revelation, that they must somehow bring me closer to God. And on occasion, they did, like when we delivered those quilts to battered women's shelters. Other times, I'd see these quilts, when made, draped over fancy Italian sofas at my leader's home, something that felt more like church-funded, watered-down child labor. The homemaking skills we'd acquired, we were promised, would also lead us to our eternal companion. And these young men, we were told, wanted spatula-wielding women wrapped in floral aprons and gleaming smiles and silence. But a few years in and feeling no closer to God, I concluded that casseroles and holiday cookies weren't another form of baptism, and that babysitting did not purify my soul. This narrative, this map of femininity encompassing only marriage, motherhood, and eternity, felt all too restrictive to me at 15. On a Sunday I later wish I'd skipped, my young woman leader, Sister Larson, a homely woman in a boxy jean jumper, announced it would spend that Tuesday's activity at the local David's Bridal. "We're going to try on wedding dresses," she exclaimed and clasped her hands together. The collective uproar of giggles tore through my daydreams of perfectly arced jump shots and the gentle swish of the net. The girls next to me squealed in delight as Sister Larson's eyes widened, her smile stretching over her cheekbones. "We're trying on wedding dresses to remind you, ladies, to keep yourselves morally clean and worthy for temple marriage." My body wilted as I crossed my arms across my stomach and dug my toes into the carpet. Slumped over, I scratched at my forehead nervously and raised my hand. Sister Larson turned to me and raised her eyebrows, the nonverbal go-ahead. "Is someone getting married?" I asked timidly. This was, of course, code for my real question. "Did someone get pregnant?" Sister Larson giggled and swatted the air in front of her. "No, Whitney, nobody's getting married yet, but you all will someday. It is girls, our calling and our duty." I thought of my mom's friend Stella, who had never married, and wondered if her leader had told her the same thing. I smiled and nodded as Sister Larson studied my reaction. "Whitney, don't you want to try on a wedding dress?" I only shrugged and slid my hands between my thighs and the stiff orange plastic of the chair, imagining the crisp click of high heels on the glossy wooden tiles of a basketball court. Megan fanned her face frantically and gushed, "I want yards and yards of fabric and a really long train." "Oh, me too," Ashley agreed, "and a square neckline." Danielle nodded, "I want lots of detail, like beads and sequins and lace. I want it out."
Sharif Suk to Graham Hancock, February 2001. "I've noticed an interesting correlation between the Horry-Reynal map of 1510 and Glenn Milne's late 20th century computer-generated inundation maps of the coastlines of India. There's an obvious correlation to the Cantino, 1502, and also the Ptolemaeus Argentinae, 1513. The correlation to the inundation maps is not perfect. The inundation maps show a clear land bridge between India and Sri Lanka, whereas Reynal, 1510, has not drawn a land bridge. Being Portuguese and living during the time of the Portuguese discovery of India, Raynal would have been a laughingstock if he had failed to depict the island of Ceylon, or Sri Lanka. Curiously, however, because he had access to earlier maps, Raynal has drawn dots in the shape of the land bridge across the Palk Strait. It gives the impression that Ceylon is too close to the mainland. Perhaps Raynal was indicating dangerous shallows, but a glance at my bathymetry data shows there are no such shallows. I believe he was trying to reconcile common knowledge of Ceylon as an island with earlier sources that depict truly a land bridge. Whitney is drawing dots on the map. Mr. Benefideo to T.S. Spivitz. A map does not just chart, it unlocks and formulates meaning. It forms bridges between here and there, between disparate ideas that we did not know were previously connected. To do this right is very difficult.
I wanted out. When I arrived home from church, I told Mom that I wouldn't make it to the following Tuesday's activity, although I didn't specify what that activity involved. When she asked why, I lied. Coach is extending our practice because we've lost, like, 4 games in a row. Well, that's too bad, Mom said and put her book aside. When do you play this week? Wednesday's game is at home and Friday's is at Orem, I think. Great, she said. I can make it to both. She smiled and gently raked her fingers through my hair. I liked that Mom was usually in the stands. Besides the fact that she kind of adored me, I think she liked watching me play because she was, and still is, such a tremendous athlete. My siblings and I got our athleticism from Mom, a secret we all know, but keep from Dad. From Dad, I got stubbornness and a temper. Hey, Mom, I started. What do you wear to get married? Mom sighed. Well, it depends on where you get married. She brushed her bangs away from her face with her index finger. If you get married in the temple, if you're worthy, you usually wear temple clothes. If you get married somewhere else, girls typically wear a wedding dress. I listened with my brow furrowed and lips pursed. So you don't have to wear a wedding dress in the temple to get married. You can. Some girls do. But most get married in temple clothes and then change into a dress for the reception. Huh. So you don't have to be worthy to wear a wedding dress. No, anyone can wear them. And if I got married, I wouldn't have to wear one at all if I didn't want to. It's not required or anything. Mom chuckled. No, sweetie, it's your choice. You could wear your Nikes and a t-shirt if you wanted. The Sunday following the wedding dress activity, our leaders posted the pictures of the girls on the blackboard and passed around additional copies for us to admire. I didn't tell Sister Larson about my conversation with Mom, that I'd really learned how little a dress had to do with worthiness and purity. Instead, I sat silently in the corner, hunched over like a burlap sack of all the wrong angles. Leslie passed me the pictures, but didn't ask where I'd been that Tuesday. And as I thumbed through the photos, I noticed an alarming trend. Each girl had been pictured in the same dress. No long train for Megan or square neckline for Ashley, and no intricate detailed embroidery for Danielle. Just smiling carbon copies. That was the last time I attended Young Women's.
Graham Hancock. Traditions regarding the lay of the land, with all their folksy redolences, are relatively safe matters to speculate about. Maps and nautical charts, which are clearly used by local navigators, these are another thing altogether. Those whose lives depend upon knowing the waters they sail should never take the risk of actually using an inaccurate map for navigation.
Between the last excerpt that I read and this one, I'm 18. My parents had announced a divorce, and for certain reasons that we'd all stayed together in the same house for a few years, which was lovely. So at this time, I'm a senior in high school and kind of thinking ahead, and had quit basketball for several reasons. By my senior year, Mom and Dad refused to speak to each other. Mom worked on her PhD in social psych, Thanks, Mom. Give me some. Bedtime. Mom worked on her PhD in social psych at BYU, something that marked her as a Mormon renegade and something that I often bragged about when I ran into women from our neighborhood. Meanwhile, I took advantage of an empty house during the hours I should have been in school. I spent most of those hours at home reading, writing, listening to music, or watching trash TV. High school wasn't something I ever took seriously. It was shallow and it was fake, and I rebelled by academically screwing myself as I rarely attended class and marked a straight line of C's down the ACT score sheet. But when I realized that college meant out of Orem, that it wasn't centered around prom or the football team, I crossed my fingers, applied to Utah State University, and got accepted under academic probation. And Mom was still proud. About a month before I left for college, Mom interrupted an intense game of hotshot to tell me that I had a visitor. My siblings continued to play without me, and when I approached the door, I saw Debbie Hutchins, another of my former Young Women leaders and a notorious ward gossip. I knew she'd told people that the divorce was punishment for our lack of familial righteousness, that we probably didn't pray enough. Her daughter had repeated it to my sister Carly, and Carly had cried and cried, agonizing over her potential contribution to the obliteration of our eternal family. As I got closer to the door, my insides groaned, and I noticed her thin, dangling hair above her thin hair dangling just above her shoulders, her two front teeth yellow and overlapping. "Well, hello, Miss Whitney," she exclaimed as her head bobbed rhythmically. "Hi, Sister Hutchins," I said flatly and forced a smile. "I just stopped by to see if you'd like to go on a quick walk." She reached over and pinched my arm with the same enthusiasm with which she spoke. Yeah, sure," I nodded and shut the door behind me. As we stepped onto the road, the gravel dug into the tender bridges of my feet. As we walked, Sister Hutchins placed her hand on her chest and inhaled deeply. "It just breaks my heart that your parents are breaking up." Her voice quivered and she added, "And it just breaks my heart that you kids are going through all this." I kicked the gravel, wanting to grab her by her shoulders and shake her until her eyes rattled in their sockets. Instead, I kept my eyes on my feet. "It'll be better once we move." She dabbed her eyes with a Kleenex. "Well, it'll be a world of change, little lady. I hope you're ready for it." "I guess so," I shrugged. "Oh, honey, you better be," she sniffled and continued. "You're about to be a little mother." I stopped, my mouth open and full of dread. "I don't know, I'm not pregnant or anything," I stammered. "Oh, bless your heart," she giggled. "Of course you're not pregnant. I just mean with your family. When your parents move, your father will be..." She stopped for a moment and continued with more certainty. "There's got to be a woman in the home, Whitney. There's got to be a homemaker. It's our calling."
Sven Burkert's. Some juxtapositions work, others don't. Some blank spaces invite speculation, while others feel like careless omissions. Boris to T.S. Spivitz. "I'm sorry to say, my man, but there's a lot that doesn't show up on maps. And that which does not show up is precisely what we are most interested in."
"There's got to be a woman in the home, Whitney," she said. "There's got to be a homemaker. It's our calling." I tried to blink away the echoes of Little Mother, a phrase that resurrected images of wedding dress photos from years earlier, and not even I could recall the individual girls. Just smiling, interchangeable faces attached to assorted silhouettes drowning in the same white dress. I turned around and slid my hands into my pockets. "I have school in the fall. I'm leaving, you know, so yeah." "I know you have your own plans," she said, and smoothed the front of her synthetic blouse. "I just hope our talk gives you a little perspective." On the walk home, the visions of polished wood floors and school classrooms dissolved. I only saw my veiled face fading into the esoteric plainness of white, the only image projected into eternity. 2 years following my departure from Utah State have mostly faded into obscurity, and only my most beloved and painful memories have managed to survive. I know that sometime during my 19th year, I morphed into an adult, a third parent of sorts. I worked and spent my free time running errands and mediating disagreements, but I also hung out with my mom and siblings. Of course, Mom and Dad were actively involved, Mom a little more than Dad, but I, a warrior by nature, tried to make up for any kind of absence or inconsistency by being unconditionally available. I helped Carly get ready for her school's preference dance in the downstairs basement. She wore a gorgeous red dress we called Ruby, and I curled her hair and applied her makeup using the less is more rule. Rhett and I discussed classic rock. I remember hearing Kashmir over and over again as he stood right on the brink of his Led Zeppelin obsession. Okay. Scooter and I read The Outsiders together. We both agreed we liked Dally and 2-Bit the best. These moments helped to assure me that my siblings were stable and healthy, that they would not be one of the variety of troubled kids who strayed from the rod that LDS films like Saturday's Warriors had showcased, the musically gifted bandana and leather boot wearing teens with cut-off shirts or big hair. But as I acted out a traditional narrative so intimately mapped into my ideology, my own feelings of absence and limitation crept in. I don't know when I realized it, or if it was something gradual, like boiling water, but at 21, I discovered that I'd lost myself. I'd left my only access to identity on the basketball court years earlier and had since become a fragmented collage of my siblings and outdated young women's activities with no real reference point to myself before the divorce. Mutually driven by love and duty, I'd taken on a role I was not equipped to perform and had no real desire to play. Panic drove me to Mom's house that day for some sanity, wisdom, and junior mints. As usual, Dr. Nelson set aside her class materials and we sat on the sofa as I frantically spat out my concerns and worries. "I just don't know what I'm doing," I said. "I mean, what the hell am I doing? I'm not doing anything. I'm 21 and I'm not doing anything. I don't even have friends. I have you and Carly, Rhett, and Scoot. That's it." I stood and paced and closed my eyes. "Is this some kind of identity crisis? Am I going crazy?" I asked as I sank back into the sofa. "Well, no," Mom smiled. "But are you doing what you want to do?" she asked. "No," I said sharply. "I thought I was. I'm doing what I thought I was supposed to do, and I hate it." She breathed heavily, inhaling her patience and wisdom before she spoke again. "Whitney, your dad and I can parent. I know you feel like you need to be here, and you know that I appreciate your help, but the kids are fine. You need to decide what you want to do, and do it. You have absolutely no reason not to. Don't be afraid, and don't worry what anybody else thinks." She brushed her fingers through my hair and tilted her head. "Do you think you'd like to go back to school?" I flexed my jaw and clenched my teeth, a feeble and ineffective attempt to withhold my tears before I whisper what is my first reference point in a newly revised narrative. "I think I'd like English."
Sven Burkert's "A Shift in Perspectives Draws a New Circle Around What We Know and Makes All Things Seem Possible Again."
3.5 years after I enroll at Utah Valley University, I still won't know what to make of my experiences, and I still won't know what it means to be a woman, but I will know not to look for a formulaic answer. My first theory class will be taught by the wispy and brilliant and former Mormon professor Dr. Karen Anderson, who will require us to read literature like Alice Munro's short story Boys and Girls, beautiful stories about unnamed female author narrators who grow up outside of gender boundaries only to be integrated, forced, or seduced into the margins of a more traditional narrative. The piece will resonate with my Mormon upbringing, a place where I'd been inscribed with ideals of preserving femininity, a place of truths and absolutes, a place where I felt incompetent, fragile, and othered. I will want to start over, to start before Mormonism and tradition, before my own experiences even, and a part of me will think that I can. But Dr. Anderson will remind me that I can't ignore, change, or find any semblance of peace with my narrative, experiences, and ultimately my identity without facing some pretty troubling questions. Questions that will evolve and fracture my own consciousness in both beautiful and tragic ways. Rupture, obliterate, negotiate, she'll say. And I will.
T.S. Spivet. "When I make a map that exactly captures what it is trying to map, it is like I already knew this map existed. I was just copying it. And this gets me to thinking, if the maps already existed, then the world already exists, and the future already exists. Is this true?" Join me in wishing Whitney well on the journey of exploration she has barely begun.
We have have a good amount of time left over for questions. Thank you to Whitney for that beautiful piece and Julie for her good call and response. That was actually, I think, far more fun than an explication. If you could come up to the microphone for questions, or if you need me to bring the microphone to you, just raise your hand. Speak loudly so people can hear you. The sessions are recorded for posterity. Fun. And we'll leave the time open to you. You have about 20 minutes.
What a gift. I see it as a movie. Like Julia and Julia. Julia and Julia.
Julia and Whitney, yes.
I see it as a movie. I think it would be so fabulous. Julie, you're bringing this man into his views. It's just like elegant. It's just an elegant way to look at mapping. Mapping is a fabulous way to look at our predicament because we have been mapped. And looking back at my map, I did get a few giggles on it. I mean, we were given good maps.
That may be bad.
But they are maps. So, you know, at the accuracy of our maps, we always need to be checking. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I'll just see if I can get up.
We can hear you, Mary. You're okay.
Or we can bring the mic to you.
Yes, let's do that.
Paul's got it, I guess.
There you go.
My daughter is now 47 years old, and she was the daughter of the bishop. When she was 12, they would have a lesson on wedding dresses, and the boys were going to the White House. So she led her beehive girls into the bishop's office, her father's, and said, "We protest. The church is unfair to blacks, women, and beehive girls." So the point is, she's 47 now. How long ago was that? And it was the same when I was a girl. Might have been worse, yes. We have not gone very far with this, have we? So we're looking to people like you to make the difference. Thank you.
I have a question. Is the wedding dress thing, have other people, I did not grow up with this wedding dress obsession in Western Washington. The rest of you have experienced this?
I have.
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry.
I was hoping it was an unfortunate anomaly.
I'm going to say something at the mic here, just to record it for posterity. I have more and more posterity, so I'm excited about preserving
six and a half.
I've been reading some really fascinating things about the kinds of maps that are in existence now, they're extant, that were drawn up in such antiquity that sort of ordinary people can't believe it, and so they deny them. Maps that show Antarctica not under an ice cap, and all the modern technological soundings about what Antarctica looks under the ice cap correspond to them exactly. I mean, these maps are thousands of years old, and they had to have been drawn by people who had technology at least as good as ours or better, because longitude requires knowledge, accurate chronometers, accurate time measurers, as well as distance measurers. It's incredible. Where did they come from? The analogy is that the true map of who we are in relation to God, the true map of what we are as human beings on Earth, is that ancient and more. And inundations and cataclysms have made it so that sort of the surface map that's getting drawn has obvious inaccuracies to anyone who has access to that which is more ancient and more accurate and more true. And this is one of the things that I agree with Mary, that that Whitney is part of the upcoming generation to look at and to say, this map is clearly inaccurate and true maps exist. Where do we find them? One of the places we find them, Barfield says, is in that interior place that language shows us was there before. We are daughters and sons of a Heavenly Father. No question. And the maps that are sort of superimposed on that are inaccurate. And it's up to us to say so and to navigate our lives by them. Otherwise, we're going to wreck on the shoals. And that's, I think, our point. And I think that what do we do about it is continually come back to the truer map. Just continually come back to it over and over again. Show how it works and the other maps don't.
The true map being
the true map can be found, I think, if you will begin to ask, who am I? What is my relationship to God? What is my place as a human being on this earth? It's a huge question. It's not easily answered. I can't say the true map is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and go to the temple and pray and read your scriptures. That's a map. But I think there's something else behind it and beneath it and more ancient that includes it. And I think each one of us has to continually ask these questions. I don't find that difficult. I don't find it difficult to ask a lot of questions while I'm the education counselor in the Relief Society. I know a lot of the women in my ward do. But that's just, I don't know how not to. Let's put it that way. And I'm not finding too much that makes me want not to serve my sister. But I am finding a lot that tells me there's a great deal out there that confirms who I really am as a human being on this planet. That's very big, very big. So I encourage everyone to find their map and navigate by it. That's what I encourage you to do.
Either works.
I have found this absolutely stunningly beautiful. And I'm going to try very hard not to say all sorts of things I want to say about Julie, because I have so many memories. And to sit here at her feet and be instructed and to learn all, is just overwhelming to me. My first memory of her, well, I don't know if it was the first, but she was in a class, and she was about 8.5 months pregnant and asking the most wonderful questions and, just forging on. I'm not going to that. But what you've been talking about language and the maps, and that the map, I had never heard this about the really, really ancient maps, which is stunning to me, too. What I've been reading recently are some of the ancient scrolls that have been uncovered more recently, that most of the world, of the Christian, committed Christian world, is just not taking into account. Nope, nothing there. Didn't really exist. Doesn't exist. But also, as you talk about language, I was just fascinated by the evolution and the transformation things and how that works. And I think of what we've learned about how children learn language. We used to think that they learned language from their parents. Of course, how else do they learn it? If you're Greek, you learn Greek, and if you're German or you're English or whatever. But then, Noam Chomsky and others said, no, in order for that to be true, a child would have to learn every sentence possibility from the person. from the parent. They would have to learn every sentence possibility. And they'd be 82 before they knew how to say an ironic imperative, whatever. But they don't. They learn some vocabulary, but inside, in the brain, is the mechanism for learning language patterns. It's there. So what Julie says is exactly, it makes beautiful sense. And what this young woman, Whitney, has written is breathtaking in its honesty and clarity and directness and wisdom. And I feel very heartened when I see another generation bright, intent, alive, totally individual, totally part of all of us, totally part of all of us. Thank you, sister. Thank you.
And for the tape, this is Whitney's mom speaking.
Thank you. At the time that Whitney was going to Young Women's and learning about wedding dresses and they were taking pictures, up to this point, I had never really said, wow, I really have to protest to this activity. I really need to say this. I can't support this. And we had that discussion. And my counter to that was, when I see the young women leaders bringing in catalogs from universities and talking about women's education and preparation, something besides marriage, because my sense was, and I think our sense was, and it was reality, that the young women were learning about how preparing themselves for marriage and how to stay pure, and the boys were playing basketball in the gym, scratching themselves, right? I mean, they just weren't receiving the same kind of direction. But at the time, of course, I'm in a situation where I'm going through a divorce, which that the ward I lived in was so pristine that we had still been the only divorce in the ward. And so I knew I would hear that sour grapes, and we kind of kept it to ourselves. And anyway, I did go to graduate school, and as fate would have it, or divine intervention, I, as a graduate student, kind of created a niche for myself teaching psychology of gender. I'm a psychologist. And so, thank you, Whitney. So I'm teaching psychology of gender, and we're exploring the ways, especially evident in our religion, that men and women, young men and women of all ages, children and men and women, receive different maps about what it is to be feminine, what it is to be masculine. And we start this off, and I am very gentle in the beginning because I teach at BYU, and you can imagine that this is a very controversial concept for BYU students who come in with this idea of the proclamation to the family. And I hold it up, and we talk about it a little bit, and I throw around the F word, that's the feminism word, right? And I bring out the dictionary and get a literal definition of it and try to dispel any kind of ideas that this is an evil idea. And we discuss what it means to, you know, what kind of language we're hearing, what we're being taught about being feminine and masculine. Of course, traditionally, femininity has been looked at as, you know, being compassionate and loving and kind and loving children, but it's also been considered women are more gullible. They're less independent. Of course, there's no language in femininity that has been ambitious or intelligent or athletic or any of these words that are reserved for masculinity. And also, in contrast, men have not been looked upon as being compassionate, loving, kind, caring for children. And we discussed the literature, the research that shows how difficult it is for men and women to form relationships, productive, healthy relationships, when you have a hyper-masculine male and a hyper-feminine female. And to address your question, so what is our map? I always bring up the Savior and say, if we want to look to a figure who is absolutely androgynous in the sense that androgyny, the research would show, the definition would be that he possesses both stereotypical female and stereotypical masculine characteristics, and together it makes him whole. Together it will make us whole. And so near the end of our semester, the students give a presentation on anything gender-related, and two students decided to discuss and explore chivalry, right? And so they interviewed some people. So Dr. Nelson, can we interview them? You make sure you get signatures if you're going to tape record them. So they tape recorded some really excellent younger students who talked about, you know, chivalry, why don't we, instead of thinking about chivalry, why don't we talk about it in the sense of charity, that males and females can both be charitable to one another instead of chivalry, kind of the connotation there is that it would be more male. So they also interviewed one of the institute teachers. And this gentleman happened to be in my state presidency, and he's older. He's probably in his 70s. And he's tape recording. It's big as the room, you know, and all my students were near the end of the semester. And he kind of, in his own way, reiterated everything we had talked about during the semester. Men and women are different. They're like two shears, two parts of a shear, very different, but they go together. Men are to provide. Men are strong. Men are, and he goes down the list, and women are compassionate and caring and loving. And by now, my students are giggling, right? Which really makes me happy to feel like we've evolved to a point that they understand that what's important is that we are human beings, that we're caring, loving human beings, and that we map ourselves, I believe, after our Savior, who is such a perfect example of every possible desirable characteristic for us. So that's what I have to say about, as a result of those kind of experiences, I have two daughters and two sons, and when their friends come to our house, they'll say, oh, those Nelsons, they're kind of liberal. You know, they talk about everything in their house, because nobody will come to our house and make a comment like, ooh, that's so gay, because Whitney would say, wait a minute, you know, what is your language saying? That's disparaging a group of people. And they certainly know that we're I'll speak for myself. I think I could throw Whitney in there. A Democrat among a very, very homogeneous group of people in Orem, Utah, which separates us somewhat, but it's nice that we're having some really good dialogue in our home about the kind of maps, messages that the kids are receiving, and maybe how we can look at that differently and really kind of map ourselves. I hope what they take away from their experience in our home is map ourselves after our Savior instead of listening to these messages that culture, and I prefer to look at it as culture rather than religion, because I think you probably had a different experience if you live outside of Utah being raised LDS. I hope that's the case. Anyway, thank you, Whitney. That was beautiful. Thanks for letting me come. Appreciate it.
In fact, I just moved away from Utah. I have a small child and kind of reiterated my decision. Thanks once again to Whitney and to Julie for this lovely presentation. It's time for us to end now. If you would like a flyer on the Mormon Women's Literary Tour, you can hear from Whitney again, as well as from some other fine personal essayists. The flyers are up here at the front, and we look forward to seeing you around Sunstone over the weekend.
And Dr. Nicholas will be there as well.
Oh, and
she didn't say that because she's humble, but she will.
Thanks.